This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 284.
This podcast is brought to you by Generation UCAN, the revolutionary new way for runners to fuel. UCAN keeps your blood sugar stable and allows your body to burn fat. Generation UCAN, their sugar and then their science. Use the code MTAALEXI to save 15% on your order. Since we're talking to Alexi Pappas today, that's MTAALEXI. Just note there's two A's right next to each other. MTAALEXI to save 15% on your order when you go to generationucan.com.
This episode is also brought to you by BioLite. Transform your low-light runs with BioLite Headlamp 330, an ultra-thin, no-bounce headlamp that's so comfortable you'll forget you're wearing it. Try it for yourself and find out why we think it's the best headlamp for runners out there. Go to BioLiteEnergy.com/MTA and use the code MTA at checkout for 15% off your order. Try it for 30 days, and if you don't love it, they'll take it back. That's BioLiteEnergy.com/MTA, and of course, use the code MTA.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where we empower you to run a marathon and change your life. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we bring you an interview with Alexi Pappas, Greek-American distance runner, Olympian, actor, and filmmaker. And in the quick tip segment, we discuss a study that claims that walking boosts creativity. And of course, you can get more help in taking your training to the next level inside the academy, learn about membership and our amazing coaches when you visit marathontrainingacademy.com. All right, so Angie, it's a beautiful day outside. Weather has been nicer. We've gotten some great trail runs. Unfortunately, some runners suffer with allergies this time of year. Yourself being one of them, I think, right?
Yeah, I definitely suffer for being outside too long. Even kind of get breakthrough allergy symptoms even when I'm taking medication. So definitely puts a damper on things, but I try not to let it slow me down too much.
Yeah, it doesn't keep you from getting out there. So definitely feel the pain, all you allergy sufferers out there who have to run and deal with it. Well, we are definitely excited about this interview. It was great to speak with Alexi Pappas, someone that we've been following on social media and following her career. So we look forward to bringing this conversation to you guys. Before we do, we'd like to give some shout-outs to some folks in the Academy who are doing awesome things.
That's right. We'd like to say congratulations to members Elena and Jen, who recently ran their first half marathons. So that's a great breakthrough right there. We got this note from Caitlin. She says, today I ran my fifth half marathon at the Long Island Half Marathon. This is my hometown race. Despite the rain, I was looking forward to achieving a new PR, and that I did by over 6.5 minutes, coming in at 2 hours and 16 minutes. Huge thanks to Coach Dominique for helping me get this accomplished. Now on to training for the New York City Marathon in November. We had a couple other members in the Academy recently run their first 50Ks. Emily says, my friend Tina and I can officially say we're ultra marathoners. Yesterday, we both completed our first ever 50K in the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. And Rachel reports in, she says, another running goal accomplished, to finish my first 50K in the year I turned 50. Done and done at the Mount Si Relay and Trail Runs. I missed my A goal of 7 hours by 1:47, but I met my B goal to finish happy. Just finishing was gratifying because this was my first race in which the last 10K were basically a tour of the pain cave.
I like it. Tour of the pain cave. That's a good way to put it. Congrats on that. Epic accomplishment, Rachel. 50K at 50. That's awesome.
And Kathleen writes, I recently ran the Nashville Marathon, my first ever race as a marathon maniac. Well, before mile 16, my Fitbit crashed, so I had to run by feel. I felt good overall despite the heat and hills and ended up with an unexpected PR time of 4 hours and 24 minutes, so I can't complain. Thanks to Coach Lynn for helping with recovery and training advice.
That's awesome. You know, I run with an Apple Watch. It seems like it never makes it to the end, because I'm always playing music too. So it just can't last long enough. Maybe I need to run faster.
Yeah, a lot of times, found like more serious, longer distance runners often don't use the Apple Watch for that reason that it, just can't really keep up with battery life.
Oh, no, it can't. After about 3 hours, 3.5, it's done. But I do love the ability to manage my playlist and check my email right there on my watch.
Why wouldn't you want to check your email while you're running a marathon, right?
Yeah, exactly. Something to do.
I think that means you're not running hard enough. Well, back to the Nashville Marathon, we got a report from Marty as well. He said, I had a good day in Nashville and ran a solid race. I haven't run a good marathon since 2014 and ran very inconsistently in 2016 and 2017. But I rebooted my running in January of 2018 and basically started over, hoping to get back into marathon shape again. I felt I was ready, but not race tested, so I didn't know what to expect. But I'm pleased with my effort and the results. Maybe these old legs have more marathons in them after all. And Marty finished in 3 hours, 36 minutes for first in his age group of the 60 to 64-year-old age group.
That's awesome. Well, congrats, Marty from Colorado, on the first place finish. I think that's a good lesson for all of us. You know, sometimes your running can kind of, you know, go through a hard time, kind of take a dip in performance or motivation or whatever, but you can come back to it and still get a lot out of yourself.
Yeah, and actually sometimes starting from the ground up, just really rebuilding a solid base, can be what a lot of people need to get past injuries and, you know, to really feel like they have a strong start to marathon training again. And this final note comes from Henry. He says, sometimes we do hard things. Major props to MTA coach Steven for an audacious training block that had me ready for my first 100K at U-Rock in Virginia. And special thanks to the MTA community for your support on this journey.
Yeah, and it's been quite a journey for him. Henry's such a go-getter, but he qualified for Boston, you know, 1 year and then didn't make the cutoff and then was signed up to do this 100K and had to have emergency abdominal surgery, right?
That's right.
He wrote about it on our blog. And then so got recovered, qualified for Boston again, ran it this year, and just did this 100K, his first 100K. So awesome stuff. And he's been working with Coach Steve Walden, who is also an ultra marathoner. So we sent a lot of ultra clients to Steve. Congrats, Henry, and keep up the great work. Well, congrats to everyone out there just taking action in your health and in your running, making progress. We're glad to be on this running journey with you, and we hope you enjoy this conversation with Alexi Pappas. She's definitely a very inspiring person. She represented Greece in the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio in the women's 10K event, and she actually set a national record for her country in 31:36:16. And she's since moved up to the marathon distance with an eye toward representing Greece in the 2020 Games. She lives and trains in California, just recently moved to LA, and she ran the Chicago Marathon last year in 2:43:38, so looking to improve on her time.
It was her first marathon.
Yep, her debut marathon. So we'll ask her about that. How did it feel to go from middle distance up to marathon? What the marathon revealed, you know, to her, like it does to all of us that try to run them. Alexi's also an actor, and she has starred in the movies Trektown and Olympic Dreams. So, without further ado, here's our conversation with Alexi Pappas. Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way. Now that I'm well on my way, well on my way, well on my way, well on my way. Okay, we're on the podcast now with Alexi Pappas. Alexi, great to have you on the MTA podcast.
So nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, let's go back a ways and tell us, at what point did you realize that you wanted to pursue professional running?
You know, I think for me, all of the opportunities in my life and my Olympic opportunity in particular have come about from finding people who believe in me enough to help me believe in myself. And so for the Olympic pursuit or the professional running pursuit, that really came about organically and not until my final year, running a fifth year with the University of Oregon, when I met in the Eugene community these professional runners on the Oregon Track Club Elite and learned that, one, that's a career option, which I wasn't so familiar with. I didn't necessarily grow up being super aware of professional running, and two, understanding that that was an opportunity that I could have. Hmm. So I was a later bloomer in the sport and always, I think, had a goal that was one notch ahead of where I was, but that has grown. So when I was younger, the goal was simply to matter on the team I was on, and then it could grow to mattering in the NCAA and then mattering, it grew.
So it's hard for us to appreciate just the kind of pressure that you guys face and what that was like. And just off mic a little bit, we chatted about that. So can you kind of share what it's like, you know, as a professional athlete, as an Olympian, just the pressure maybe that you put on yourself and pressure that's perceived to be external as well?
Yeah. So I think the big difference at an elite level or at even a collegiate level from an everyday running perspective might be that we want to matter to something greater than ourselves. You know, when you're on, I think the pressure to make the Olympics is substantial, but I felt that similar pressure being on a team at Oregon that could win a national title. Like that felt like the weight of a team on me. And so I think we're seasoned, you know, throughout our career, starting in college or maybe earlier, to just want to matter. And that's a privilege because you can matter and you can make a difference. And it's also, you know, it's a backpack you can wear however joyously or negatively if you see the pressure as a bad thing. And for me, I think I tried to see all this pressure more in the lens of opportunity. So, you know, I knew that the person who put the most pressure on myself was me. And knowing that was just being aware of that is really healthy and really helpful, because then you have the perspective of, yes, I still want these things, but, you know, I care the most about it. And that was the case for me. I think I was lucky to grow up with a dad who was, you know, exponentially proud of me forever, but who did not, I don't think his ego rested on the success of my career. And, you know, just to add to that, I actually had this realization recently about coaching. And that is that I think it's so important to find a coach whose ego does not rest on your success, mm-hmm. who, you know, it's all good. It is great if you do well. But when a coach, when you're around an environment where it feels like your success is going to matter in a way where, you know, the ice cube might get squeezed too tight and slip out, it will slip out. And I thought about that recently, and I think it's really, it's powerful. And it took me a while to realize what was so great about my coaches in the past. And it was that their egos have not rested on my success.
It's always fun to talk to, you know, elite runners who've had really high level coaching, and there's always certain things that they learn or picked up from their coaches. We talked to Dina Castor about Coach Vihol, and he would always tell her, bring a good attitude.
So, yeah.
Do you have any little sayings like that from some of your coaches?
Totally. So, you know, I've learned a lot from Dina actually, and Coach Castor. They're incredible. And Dina's taught me to distract yourself when you're running, which I never, you know, when you watch her run, it seems like this laser focus. And I think she does have a laser focus that allows her to, you know, surpass expectation. But I think part of her focus is being able to distract herself. And, you know, I have been on long runs with her that I really thought that I needed to stop on because it was so challenging. And she, instead of even acknowledging my pain or that I might, you know, be struggling, she distracted me by pointing out a bird. She's like, look at that bird. Where do you think he came from? Do you think he's bringing food back to his family? And there's like this wonderful thing. And I think that's probably what she does for herself too. And then the pain passes, you know? So that's something that I've learned from Dina. And there are a lot of more concrete lessons as well, but I think that one is something we can all use, mm-hmm. and just use whatever you've got. Like, you know, use any distraction that you have, especially in the marathon. There's that, it's like eye candy, right?
Yes. Spectators, other runners, just, yeah, lots of things that you'll see. I think you said associated with your first marathon, which I'd like to talk about in a bit, that the marathon gives you a lot of time to think. So kind of, you know, what did you mean by that? I mean, I totally agree. So, you know, it can be a positive thing and it can be a negative thing.
Yeah, it's, for me, I think I was in a position to run a marathon and not necessarily race a marathon, if that makes sense, when I tried it for the first time.
Yeah.
And that is fine. And I'm so glad that I learned the event, because doing it is so different than not doing it. Like, completing the distance takes away this total mystery about it. And so you can, you know, move forward and focus on not the mystery of it, but the reality of it. And in terms of having all this time to think I watched myself doing it while I did it, because there was that much time. And I got to a certain point where, like, I learned that, like, my, you know, my hamstring was not strong enough to, like, race the thing, but it wasn't injured in a way where I couldn't run the thing. And so that was interesting, because it gave me, it was like, I wasn't out of breath for my marathon. It was never an oxygen thing. It was like a mechanical problem for me, or challenge. And so the thinking was, I could think the whole time. I could breathe the whole time. I could have conversation with people the whole time. I could not get my legs to move faster the whole time. And so, talk about time to think. I was just spending, you know, 2.5 hours with myself and the world, because so many people, you know, passed me. And it was like you were in a dream almost. You know, not a nightmare, not the best dream you've ever had, but definitely a dream.
What made you decide to go up to the marathon distance?
So honestly, I think it was the belief of Dina Castor, the Castors, Ian Dobson, my coach who from Oregon, that they believed in me, was this permission to explore this sport, because they explained the marathon is a new sport. And it felt exciting because the marathon is an event that people really care about. Like, my dad's done a marathon. That's what introduced, you know, him to running and me to running, by virtue of him bringing me to his first marathon, where I ran my first 5K in Napa in 1998. Cool. And so the marathon just feels like this tradition. And I love joining traditions. I love, you know, whether it was in college and at Dartmouth, there was this tradition to, you know, have this ice sculpture in the winter and a bonfire in the fall. And I just love being a part of things that other people really love, and then adding something to it if I can. And so with the marathon, it was a tradition I was invited to join. It's a new school that I'm still attending, marathon school. And it is like, it just makes running have continued meaning for me. And as you grow up, especially having made it to the Olympics, like that was the ultimate dream. Now I need to find continued purpose in running. And the marathon, I think, opens up the door to be a part of a larger tradition.
And so what are you training for now?
I am actually about to sit down with Coach in the next week or two and plan out a very delicious fall. I don't know why I'm using this word, but of preparation for another marathon in either fall or early winter. And, you know, I'm competing for Greece, and so I don't have an Olympic trials to prepare for, but this is sort of like my Olympic trials, because if I am to compete in the marathon in Tokyo, I need to hit standards. I need to be one of the top in my country still. And so I'm dedicated to giving it that shot of, like, is this event something that I can do? And that's something that we're building towards. So I think it'll look like road races, the traditional, you know, I've not yet raced a half marathon either. So that's, we're putting one of those in there, and then a marathon.
So what are the standards to run for the Greek team? Is there a certain?
It's the same. So to run for the Greek team, it's the Olympic standards.
Okay.
And being top three. And the difference between running for Greece and running for the US is that there are not as many women who are going to be able to hit that standard. And so it'll be, a lot of countries just go on a descending order list of your personal best within the qualifying window. Mm-hmm. And so I want to be in the top three. I mean, I want to break the Greek national record. I want to, we have to look all those things up.
Okay.
I've just been
curious.
No,
like, I'm thinking, like, in terms of, like, how fast is that?
It's slower than the Olympic standard. So if I can hit the Olympic standard that just came out, I will also break the Greek national record, which is exciting because that's where the marathon started, and it should be.
Yeah.
It should be a more, you know, I'm excited to make it a faster time.
Mm-hmm. So for people who, you know, don't really know how it came about that you were running for Greece, talk about how, you know, you decided to represent Greece, of course, back in the 2016 Olympics.
Yes. So I think it goes back to, you know, why and when you chose to chase an Olympic dream. For me, my life has just been about looking at the opportunities I have and figuring out, you know, do I take them or not? And how can I make the most of the opportunities? And I'm dual citizen by birth, and I knew I had this opportunity to run for Greece or to compete, to try to compete for the U.S. And I actually sat down with Dina and talked to her, and that meant a lot to me because I think I was most nervous about what would my mentor think of my decision. And I just always wanted to be like her. And when I sat down with her, she discussed with me how I'm at a different time than she was. And when she was my age, the opportunity to make an impact as a U.S. female distance runner was a new and big opportunity. There were not so many athletes running like she was. Mm-hmm. And now what my opportunity is to create sort of that tradition or pave some kind of path in a new place. And in Greece, what I've found is that women or girls are not necessarily raised to be athletes there, even though, you know, Greeks are historically phenomenal athletes, women included. But when I go there, you know, I still get approached by little girls who ask, why do I look the way I look? Meaning, why do I have, you know, a body that sometimes more resembles a boy than a girl to them? And that is really touching to me, that it's not common, you know, for a girl to be on the soccer field or on the track. It's more common to be cheering for their brother. Like, literally, that was my experience. Wow. While I was working out around the track. It was like I was a spectacle. And I trained with boys. When I went there, there weren't distance female girls to even train with. And so for me, the choice was about that. It was also, what are my goals? And my goal was to go to the Olympics and compete there and run my best at the Olympics. And the opportunity to peak at an Olympics is different than peaking at a trials. And I did. I peaked at the Olympics. And it was really cool to do that because even my coach who coached me for the Olympics, he had the experience of peaking at the trials and not being able to then peak again a month later. And so, yes, I feel very privileged, but I also think I've made the most of the opportunity. And I think if anyone knows their goal, then they know what choices to make. If you just simplify, what is your actual goal?
So I can't imagine how exciting that must be to go to the Olympics and, you know, to represent Greece. And so just how exciting was that to set the Greek record in the 10K and just to be there in Rio?
And doesn't Greece come into the opening ceremonies first?
That's right.
Yes.
So lead the procession.
That's exciting.
Yes. So being at the Olympics as a part of the Greek team was so cool because they, oh man, this tradition started there and they really take it seriously. And what's different about a Greek Olympic dream and what I understand out of an American Olympic dream is that I felt like growing up, it was like, you know, my Olympic dream, like Alexi's Olympic dream. But when you start to compete for a country like that, where the Olympics is their, you know, culture, it's their tradition, it's something they started, it's so much bigger than you. It was like, I was joining another, you know, almost like it's not a college team, but it's that feeling of like, this is about something greater than me. And my event was first for track and field, and the athletes. So it's a smaller team, right? Like the Greeks have fewer athletes and everyone pays attention to everybody's events. Like, you know, everybody. And so they saw my race. People came to my race and it set this tone for performance. And I didn't realize that because they didn't tell me before, like, this is that important. But afterwards, it just set this spark for this team to have an impact. And we did very well as a team. And I know that my performance really lit up the spirit, and Greeks and athletes are so mental in general in a good way, where like we thrive on like belief. And so to give a bit of that to my teammates was pretty cool.
Did you stay around until the very end of the Olympics, till the closing ceremony?
Yes.
How fun. Wow.
Oh. So I competed on day one of track and field, and I stayed all the way through, you know, the whole thing. It's like a month. And what I loved also was just making a home out of the place. So, you know, some athletes, I think, try to really sterilize their Olympic experience by creating an environment that feels like any other race. And I think what I was told before, the advice I was given, is that this isn't any other race, and don't make it be. Make it be this circus, this Olympics, this big thing. And so part of that for me was like, yes, where is the best coffee in the village? What is my routine in this new place? I live here now. And that was such a pleasure. And it also makes the chaos of the Olympics something that you are embracing of and not offended by. So the Olympics is chaotic. There's unexpected things that happen, but I expected that. And I took it on as like, you know, surprises in this, you know, big birthday party, if you will, where it's like, of course, that's what this is, rather than be afraid of those, you know, changes in routine.
It sounds like a really big mountaintop experience overall. Talk about, you know, when you went back home, it's kind of like, oh, back to the real world.
Were there anti-climatic.
any mental or emotional challenges that you faced?
For sure. So there's like a post-Olympic depression that I think so few athletes are aware of before and then become aware of after, and then learn that it's so common. So there are athletes who are publicly, you know, have publicly spoken about a post-Olympic depression, whether they were injured and got last in their event or whether they won gold. So it's actually a very broad, you know, it's a very universal feeling that a lot of Olympians get. And I certainly did not expect to, and got this feeling of, oh my gosh, I have never, you know, you can't plan for the moment after an Olympics, because if you're someone who does plan for the moment after, then you're probably not going to get there in the first place. Like you're not focused enough. Yeah. It's just like, that is the pinnacle, and there's no reason to plan for the moment after, because it will limit your ability to get there or perform. It's just that kind of a thing. And so for me afterwards, it was this, you know, I wasn't sure about where I was headed in the way of running. I didn't know if I would feel like I should keep running. I didn't know if I would feel disappointed by my experience, energized by my experience. And I felt very energized by it, but also I think a little bit confused as to what to do with that energy. And, you know, you're supposed to take a break after the Olympics. And I think I was so energetic that I didn't really take that break. Like I did, I took a few days off, I took a week off, but like, it's so big what you've put into that moment that a week off or 2 weeks off that you're spending while running around in the Olympic Village is not a real break at all. You know, I took my downtime in the village, and when I got back, it was like, okay, let's begin again. Let's do the next thing. When really, I think I needed, you know, another month after that. And I didn't take that month. I just sort of began the engine again, and like, what was the next thing? And let's, you know, transition to the new season and look at new goals. And that wasn't appropriate, but I wasn't aware of just the amount of, I think, adrenal fatigue that you have, because you're running on probably the high of the Olympics. And so I think I just simply wasn't aware. And then eventually you crash, you exceed something at some point if you don't answer to it. And so it wasn't like intentional. I think none of this Olympic depression stuff is expected or intentional, but your body and your mind and your heart need what it needs, you know, they will demand it when you don't give it to them.
We see the same thing happen to marathoners, just, you know, everyday people that that we help.
And also, a lot of people are not prepared for the psychological part of it, kind of like the post-race blues. You know, you've spent maybe 4 to 5 months preparing for a big event, and then, you know, it's kind of like, it's over. What do you do next? And if you're not prepared to kind of think through that and how to implement some self-care, especially, you know, if they're maybe they're disappointed with their first marathon experience. Like you mentioned, you know, there were some biomechanical issues that the marathon brought out. And so it can be like, well, that didn't really go according to plan or how I hoped it would go. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of issues, I think.
It's almost like, you know, we know the word taper. Like we know there's like a segment of time that athletes don't like necessarily, but they follow because there's a tradition and there's an understanding that you taper, right? And so people can buy in even if they don't like running less, or maybe they love it. Maybe people love their taper. I like my taper. But maybe there needs to be a word or an assignment to the moment after an Olympics or a marathon that's like the word taper, and people can take it a little more seriously if they feel like it's not them. You know, it's like, I know the word is the break. People take a break, but maybe that doesn't have the connotation that people like. Maybe if there was a different word, like the absorption, or I don't know, something where, you know.
Just add the word strategic to it. Like, this is my strategic rest period.
Exactly. The strategic. Yeah. And it really is. It's like letting your steak rest before cutting into it. It's like, I know that's kind of the taper, but also the moment after you've done your marathon, that is just your body absorbing all that impact. And it's just as important. It feels like it's more of a thing that you assign to yourself than is universally understood, even though it's talked about, but maybe it's just not labeled properly. What do you think?
Yeah. And I think it depends on the person, you know, I guess for the average runner, maybe their event isn't obviously as momentous as the Olympics and everything. And so I guess kind of the marathon really teaches you a lot about yourself. And so, yeah, having that period of digesting whatever your event and taking that time to be good to yourself. And
I think you use the term have compassion on yourself.
Yeah.
I say be as kind to yourself as you are hard on yourself a lot. And I tell that to myself, you know, all the time.
So, yeah, that's awesome. You really have a strong following on social media, which was another thing I wanted to talk about. And, you know, I just love how real you are on there. And your fans kind of call themselves Bravies. I was wondering, you know, where that term came from, what's the backstory, and, you know, all of that.
Can we be Bravies too? That's what I want to know.
Yes, that's the thing that I love about Bravey, is that it's not a real word. It's rooted in a real word, obviously. But I think, so growing up, I noticed that the words that I was striving towards were fierce and strong, and words that actually, it wasn't my decision whether I was strong or fierce exactly. It was just confusing to me, like, because they're a little bit subjective and a little bit, you know, someone else might assign them to you. And so with Bravey, I wrote a poem that was run like a Bravey, sleep like a baby, dream like a crazy, replace can't with maybe. And my followers latched onto the word Bravey because it was a new word. And it began really organically, but what I like is that it is a choice. So it can mean whatever you want it to mean. It has obvious, you know, strength behind it in the word brave, but I like that it's just a choice you make. Instead of being something that you earn, or, you know, or that somebody else needs to tell you that you are. I like that. I like that you can just decide that you are.
It's like a state of being.
Yeah. No one has to give you permission to do it. Just do it.
Yeah. And that's really what these young athletes and any of us really is, that like, we just want permission to believe in ourselves. That's really what it comes down to, because everybody wants to, and maybe everybody secretly does, maybe they don't, but it really helps to have that confidence be a gift that we either get from somebody else or we give to ourselves by way of this made up word or whatever.
So you're also an actor, and people might know you from Track Town and from Olympic Dreams. Where did you learn to act? Is this something you just came naturally, or have you, you know, just take classes in it? How'd that come about?
I think I was a performer before I was an athlete, and the athletics was one way to perform for me. Like, running is a performance, and I love that about it. I love, like, I only really wear makeup on race day. You know, I don't wear a lot of makeup otherwise, but that's my performance. And with the acting, I think that is another form of performance that I really love. And I have not done so much formal acting training, but I did in college. I was in an improv group, a pretty serious one, that before me, Rachel Dratch from Saturday Night Live and Mindy Kaling were also in. So it was like this tradition that I joined, and it was a good balance to the running. And what I found is that I continued to like performing. It was just that running had this unique window of time when it made sense to put that first. And it still does, that my time during my days is carved out around the athletics first. Mm-hmm. But the acting has been a passion of mine like throughout. And I've had the chance to make 2 movies, and we're now developing a television show and another movie. And it's just so exciting, because for an athlete, one of the scary things is, what do you do when you're done? And I know what I'm going to do when I'm done competing at an Olympic level. And I know that I'll be able to work hard at it, because as athletes, man, we know how to work hard. And I think that what I love about the acting is that it's a discipline, and so is running. Like, we're born with certain gifts, but we can learn. We can be students of it. And I'm trying to be that as an athlete, and now slowly more and more as an actor.
And your husband is a filmmaker, right?
Correct.
I was wondering, is there much of a market or much of an appetite for running movies? I know that we love them, you know, we eat them up, but is there much of an audience or a hunger for more running related movies?
I think there's always an appetite for stories that are told in highly specific worlds that not everybody gets to see. Mm-hmm. So with Track Town and with Olympic Dreams, there's an athletic, that's the setting, is it's athletic. There's running in Track Town, and there's an Olympic Village and cross-country skiing in Olympic Dreams. But what we try to do is really use a really, really specific world to tell a pretty like universal story. About in Track Town, it's chasing a dream. In Olympic Dreams, it's a girl who is at that moment right after her competition. And then what? Like, what if you have not thought about the moment after, and that you could achieve a dream and it still feels disorienting? And so as far as the appetite for running movies, I think if there are more running movies that are made that tell stories that anyone can find their way into and that are just as specific as possible, then they'll be very successful films. But we've always set out to make movies that are not about the sport in specific. It's just, sure, the sport is such a fertile playground.
Do you find that you get, I mean, as an artistic person, do you find that you get inspiration while you're running? I mean, you know, is that part of like the distracting yourself? Do you like compose poetry while you run, or, you know, think about writing or things like that?
I do and I don't. Like, if I'm with people and teammates, I do the Dina Castor distraction thing. Like, I love, because your body's working so hard, it's nice to let your mind like flex a little bit. And so I talk to teammates when I'm with them. When I'm alone, I often listen to podcasts, because I find that running, you know, it does take a lot of my time, and I love it, but I also love using that time to learn something. And especially when training in like a really remote place where you don't necessarily have all the access in the world to certain people or mentors, I try to get that mentorship in the way of, you know, a podcast. Mm-hmm. And, but I do get ideas. Or when I'm running with Jeremy, when Jeremy is fit enough, we'll do our doubles together, and we'll definitely talk about what's going on in our edit or what's going on. So when I'm with him, we're talking about creative stuff.
Well, let's circle back to the training for a second before we let you go. What does your training look like? You said your whole day is kind of built around it. So what does that look like?
Yeah. So it's basically that the mornings are, I have this like stretching routine that I do when I wake up. I make coffee or matcha, and then I do a stretching routine that partly involves Jeremy.
Well, what do they call that? The yoga when two people do it. What is that called?
Oh, so we do that. Yeah, it's called it's aerial yoga. Uh-huh. And he will, there's just one move that he does where he kind of picks me up and it opens up your low back and it feels so good because you're using gravity to let your body fall. And it's also nice to have like a touching interaction with your husband in the morning that is like planned part of your day and is like intentional and like loving.
Okay, how long have you guys been married? That's what I want to know.
Well, we started dating 10 or 11 years ago, but we only got married about a year ago. But we might as well have been married, I think, after about year one.
Okay.
That's awesome. So you've been together a while.
I don't think Angie feels like touching me in the morning.
Well, he doesn't get up till like 9 in the morning. I get up really early, so we're on different wavelengths. But
well, so that's a thing is that like Jeremy, being a filmmaker full time, he can have a different schedule than me, but it helps me when we go to bed like closer to the same time. Not every night, but we certainly try to get up together most days, and that's like, it's helpful for me. I like my time with him in the morning. Anyway, then we go to practice. Yeah, we do the stretch and then I go train. And so the morning is the run or the workout. It's the harder part of the day. And right after that, I do like basically prehab. So it'll be at a gym, or our garage has a pretty good little gym setup that we've put together. And so I do prehab after that. And that's, you know, intrinsic strength. It's things that are uniquely imbalanced for me, which we all have.
What would be an example of something you do?
I do single leg balance. I do something where you move side to side. I really like that. I definitely fuel. So I have my like you can milkshake smoothie sort of put together. So I'll usually mix like a smoothie box mix, which is like fruit and collagen, and then I'll mix it with my Ucan and my milk, and I have that ready. I do that in the mornings.
You're using Ucan as a recovery drink?
Yes. And I also use it before, like in Rio, it was like the only thing that I knew I would have in the morning before my race is my like Ucan mixed in with whatever I could find.
Awesome.
So I have it before and after, and then I'll have it during like long runs, of course, as well. And the electrolytes are great, but the powder, the starch is good right after, especially when you're like trying to do your prehab and not having like the big meal yet. Sometimes you're just so hungry that you come home and cook and then you do the prehab later, you know?
Right.
So then I'll eat, shower, nap. I'll try to make myself nap, which is like, you know, you have to just like lay yourself down and see what happens, and then hopefully not set an alarm, but I'll usually wake up within, you know, 30 minutes to an hour, sometimes 2 hours. And then there's second training, which is usually a run, but much easier, like much lighter, you know, shorter.
More like recovery run kind of.
Yes. Like a take pictures with every dog you find, you know, stop and enjoy it basically. And then cook dinner. And I don't have any dietary restrictions, so it's pretty, you know, I eat red meat, I eat all that stuff. I think that stuff's important. And then I try to get in bed between 9 and 9:30 so that I'm like sleeping by 10. That's an ongoing goal, as you can probably hear through my tone.
Yeah, it's hard when you're in transition too, I'm sure. But yeah, I'm kind of on a similar routine with the bedtime.
Great. Yeah.
So it's like, I'm sure just all, you know, everything people think of like all the training probably, but they don't think about maybe the recovery, like the amount of sleep that and rest that it's necessary to get, and the refueling and keeping your nutrition up. That's all goes hand in hand. You can't do one without the other, really.
Right. And sometimes you just have to hear it from the right person. So I don't know who's listening, but if it helps to hear, 9 hours of sleep is important.
Yay.
Said Alexi. You know, because I didn't believe it until I heard it from the right person either. Like my dad said it a million times. And then finally one day I heard it from like someone I looked up to in a different athletic way. And that was all I needed to hear.
Yeah. The more you train, the more you need to sleep. And I think a lot of times people try to think, well, I'm going to fit in more training by sleeping less. But the results will probably not be there in that case. At some point, something's going to break down.
Yeah, your cells only know effort. So like a stressful day is just as stressful to your cells as like a 20-mile long run. And likewise, like, it needs to be fueled in the inverse, you know, mentality of like the cells only know recovery, whatever that means. That could mean that you stay up 30 minutes later to watch this movie that's like really going to make your heart happy. But if it's sleep, I mean, there's no doubt that sleep helps. There's no doubt.
For sure.
So if people want to learn more about what you have going on, where can we send them?
You can send them to my Instagram at Alexi Pappas, or you can send them to my website at alexipappas.com, which I will try to keep updated with all the fun film and running, you know, related updates as well. And my Instagram is usually the most like active form of contact. So I'll try to keep that fun and just keep posting like what I'm actually doing so people know what it looks like.
Yeah, I love those, that real snapshot into your life and
yeah.
Just all the inspiring, encouraging words that you put out there. So thank you for that.
Good luck in your upcoming marathon, whatever you decide to nail down.
Your
and
exciting
and run.
Fall.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so excited. And I think the marathon thing will be fun because it might be a little bit different than some of my peers. But, you know, it'll provide like a colorful addition to this year.
Definitely.
For the running world, for the broader running world.
That's right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
All right. Well, hope you enjoyed that conversation with Alexi. We definitely appreciate her coming on the podcast and sharing her knowledge and passion for running with us. And best wishes to her in her pursuit of her Olympic dreams. Angie, to punt on the movie that she was in.
Of course.
Did you catch that?
I did.
And big thanks to Generation UCAN for helping us arrange this interview. Alexi is a UCAN-sponsored athlete. You know, of course, you heard her explain how that she uses it as a recovery drink and for fueling. You guys probably know that we have used UCAN in tons of marathons. Angie's probably used it in like over 40 marathons or 50 marathons that she's done. We used it in the London Marathon. It's good stuff. And very gentle on the stomach. That's what we like about it. So like I said, big thanks to UCAN for helping us arrange this. And we do have a special discount code for you guys for this episode. You can save 15% on your order with the code MTAALEXI. That's MTAALEXI. Two A's right next to each other right there. MTAALEXI for 15% off. When you go to generationucan.com, see why we love it. They have a couple sample packs, a couple starter packs, you know, to get you going. And you can try the different flavors of the drink mix and the bars. That's generationucan.com. And the code is MTAALEXI for 15% off. Well, in just a minute, we want to talk about a recent study about how walking and running as well can make you more creative. It's a study out of Stanford University. Before we do that, we'd like to say a quick word of thanks to Lactigo for making this episode possible. Lactigo is a topical gel that improves athletic performance and recovery. It's an effective, fast-acting gel that has menthol and carnosine, and it helps you maximize your athletic performance and speed up your muscle recovery. Angie, I put it on before our last trail run that we did last week, and you know, we did a lot of hills and stuff, and I didn't even think about it till later that my legs never got tired the whole time we were out there.
That's amazing. Yeah, they recommend that you put it on before, like about 30 minutes before a workout, and then afterward, and it really can help maximize recovery time and keep your legs feeling as fresh as possible. And Lactigo works for all runners. It doesn't matter if you're a professional like Alexi or training for your first big race. Lactigo is only priced at $17.99, but they want to go a step further for our listeners, and they're offering a special 10% discount when you use the promo code MTA. So you can head over to lactigo.com, lactigo.com, and try it for yourself risk-free. If you don't get blown away by the results, they'll refund your money, no questions asked.
Yep, that's lactigo.com and use the code MTA. And also big thanks to Varidesk, the world's leading standing desk solution. They help professionals maintain a healthy, active lifestyle at home or at the office. Varidesk can convert any desk into a standing desk, and it's designed with a durable, best-in-class materials that will fit in any environment or workspace. And Angie, both you and I use a standing desk, and it's not like I stand all the time. I mean, I'm usually going up and down, sit, stand.
Exactly. You probably don't want to stand at a desk with your knees locked for hours on end either. That would be pretty painful and challenging on the body. So yeah, going from standing to sitting, moving around, all that's possible with Varidesk. Varidesk comes with a 30-day risk-free guarantee, and there's no assembly required. They also cover shipping both ways, so if you don't love it, they'll pick it up.
So head over to varidesk.com. That's V-A-R-I-D-E-S-K, varidesk.com/work-elevated. Once again, that's varidesk.com/work-elevated. So Angie, the other day, I was in my car listening to the TED Radio Hour, where they take TED Talks and repurpose them for the radio. And this TED Talk caught my attention by Marilee Opazo. She's a researcher at Stanford University and did a talk about how walking improves creativity based on some studies that they did. So I shared the study with you. We figured we would talk about it on the podcast.
Yeah, we thought it dovetailed nicely with our interview with Alexi because she's a very creative person. And I know we have a lot of creatively minded people in our audience. And whether you consider yourself creative or not, just the fact that moving your body, whether it be walking or running at an easy pace, really gets your mind into a more creative space.
Problem solving as well falls into that category, I think.
Yeah, that's right. So maybe talk about a little bit what they did in the test.
Well, basically they took three groups of people and they gave them a 4-minute test to come up with novel ways to use common objects. Now, this is like a creativity test called the alternate use test. So they give people an object like a key, you know, a house key, and said, how else could you use this other than to unlock a door? And it had to be novel, and it had to be realistic. Like, you couldn't say, oh, we'll use it as a magic wand, right?
I think they called it appropriate novelty.
Exactly. So one person said, well, if I was dying and I wanted to leave a message for my family or for the police, I would, you know, scratch in the dirt with this key who the murderer was that just, you know, stabbed me or whatever. And yeah, it's creative and it was novel, so that would pass as an alternate use for a key. So basically, one group sat while they came up with these ideas, and on average, they came up with 20 creative ideas per person while they were sitting there. Then they had a group that walked on the treadmill as they came up with ideas, and that group performed almost twice as well. And then they had a group that went from sitting to walking, and they drastically improved their score when they were walking versus when they were sitting. So,
and I think she said in the study that it could be running. It's just something that's a comfortable pace for you that doesn't take a lot of your attention. So probably not something where you're doing a speed workout and it's taking a lot of focus and you're having to track your splits. It's basically a run or a walk where you can just kind of let your mind wander and free associate, right?
Yeah. So Angie, have you noticed bursts of creativity when you're out there running?
Yeah, there's been a lot of long runs where, you know, you have miles and miles to go, and I often don't listen to any music or anything and just kind of let my mind wander. And yeah, I've had, you know, so many ideas. A lot of them later I think that was ridiculous, but some of them have been really good ideas and have turned into podcast episodes, things I've been able to implement in my personal life, you know, of course, in my work. So yeah, I really enjoy that time to just kind of let my mind run, as Dina Castor says.
That's right. That's funny because we mentioned Dina Castor when we were talking to Alexi, and I didn't even know, like somehow I'd not heard that Dina was Alexi's mentor.
Yeah, and I believe Dina's husband, Coach Castor, has worked with Alexi as well.
Yeah, so I'm glad I just happened to mention her.
Yeah.
And I guess we should tell people, by the way, that Dina Castor's book is called Let Your Mind Run.
Yeah, excellent book for anyone who's looking for a good read. And of course, it's a long known fact that aerobic exercise can boost your brain health. And I found another study from the University of Bristol that tracked 200 students and faculty and found that those who performed aerobic exercise, like running, at the beginning of the day were 23% more productive than those who did not. So there's definitely a lot of research that goes to support the fact that running can make you a more creative and productive person.
Yeah. Now, you just said at the beginning of the day, right? So props to all you morning exercisers out there, which is probably most of you. Starting your day off right. Sometimes I procrastinate my run until like 2 in the afternoon. It doesn't prevent me from being a creative genius, though, does it, Angie?
just because it's your birthday tomorrow, I'm going to say yes.
So in this TED Talk, and I encourage you guys to go watch it if you want to hear the whole spiel, but the presenter also shared some tips on how to do it right. So to get the most out of your creativity while you're out there walking or running, here are some tips from the TED Talk we'll share with you really quick.
Yeah, if you want to become more creative in your own life, the first thing to do is to pick a problem to brainstorm. So it's going to be something that you're thinking of ahead of time before you go out for your run or walk. The second thing to do is to run at a comfortable pace while you're brainstorming. So that means leaving the music and podcasts off probably, so you can just kind of let your mind fully immerse itself in the problem that you want to brainstorm about. The third step is to come up with as many ideas as you can and immediately record your ideas on your phone. They say it's important to get them down right away, because often if you wait till you get home to write them down, we often self-edit a lot more. We're like, oh, that's not worth writing down. Oh, that sounds stupid now. So it kind of limits your creativity if you wait. So immediately, you know, if you have a voice recorder app on your phone, immediately just kind of talk into your phone your ideas. And the fourth thing is to cap your time. So don't force yourself to continue thinking about it if you're not coming up with ideas, because that can kind of hinder the creative process. So if, you know, nothing is coming to mind, just kind of shelve it, you know, put it into the back of your mind, and probably your brain will come up with some things later when you're not expecting it.
So, of course, these studies show us that it works, but I haven't heard why, like what physiologically is going on inside the body, inside the brain, that makes us more creative when we're exercising. That could be a talk for another time.
Well, I think one of the reasons that running can boost your brain power is that it stimulates the growth of gray matter, which is linked to thinking and memory. It also floods your brain with oxygen, which is going to improve your ability to think right there. Mm-hmm. Often we don't breathe deeply enough during the day. Running also boosts your mood, lowers stress hormones, and of course releases endorphins, those feel-good chemicals. And kind of probably all those factors working together maybe just kind of unlock that creative process.
Oh, thank you, Angie. You had that at the ready. I appreciate that.
I did. I like to be prepared.
We'll have a link to the TED Talk that we referred to and other studies that we came across over on our website with the show notes to this episode and links to find Alexi online if you want to engage with her. Tell her you enjoyed her interview on the MTA podcast. That would probably make her day. And if there's any way we can help you in your marathon training, let us know. We have a contact form on the site as well. We try to answer all the emails that we get. Of course, if you want to really take your running to the next level, we have some spots open right now in our coaching program. If you want to get trained up solid for races that you're doing this fall, just go to marathontrainingacademy.com. Thanks again to Lactigo for sponsoring this episode. They make a topical gel that improves athletic performance and recovery. Just go to lactigo.com and use the code MTA for a special 10% discount. Well, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for being a listener. And remember, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way. Hey, hey, now that I'm well on my way.